Our subject this morning is Let Dharma Be Your Guide. The meaning of the word dharma is duty, but a particular kind of duty above all. That is to say, that duty which leads you to a realization of your highest self. There are lower and higher forms of duty, and we could take the word to mean simply your worldly duty. But in the highest sense, in the true sense, the word dharma means that action which leads you toward God realization. Whenever we think in terms of duty, we tend to think of something of a burden, something that goes against our desires, that goes against our pleasures. And in fact, we do wake up, as Yogananda said in that passage that Durga just read, we wake up from the dreams of childhood to the realization that it can't be a Peter Pan existence forever. We have to assume the burden of working and supporting ourselves and supporting our families. And so people tend very often to lose touch with that beauty that they experienced as children in their engulfment, you might say, in duty. But this too is a kind of dream. And so it would be true to say, when you wake up in God, I slept and dreamed life was only duty, and I woke up and found life is beauty. And so you see that the saints, even though doing their duty in this world, do it with a sense of beauty, do it with a sense of joy, with a sense of privilege, with a sense of the love that comes when you're sharing with other people, with a constant flow of inspiration. And this is the kind of attitude with which we want to approach the whole subject of dharma, so that we realize that even if it may be difficult in the first, in the beginning, because it requires a certain disciplining, once you've got all your energies in the right direction, there is only joy. I'll give a personal example that I, in my spiritual life, for many years, was always torn in two opposite directions, mutually, it seemed to me, contradictory. On the one hand, I wanted to live the life of a hermit. I wanted to be withdrawn from society. I remember a period of time that I lived in the Himalayas and, didn't speak to anybody, didn't have anything to do with the world outside. I spent 12 hours a day meditating and reading spiritual books, and it was a wonderful period of my life. And I felt that I could easily and gladly spend my whole life that way. And on the other hand, I knew that at the end of this period, I had to go out and teach. And I had a whole lecture program set up, many different cities, classes every night, thousands of people literally coming to the lectures and classes and so on. And I remember the first day when I had to break my silence and talk again. And for that whole day, it wasn't as if I was literally shaking, but inwardly I felt as if my whole nervous system were just shaken by the unaccustomed energy of having to use words as opposed to the deep silence I had been enjoying. On the one hand, thus, there has been always that hermetical trend. On the other hand, there's been the tendency, the moment I feel even a bit of joy, to think, how can I share this with everybody? And thus wanting to go out there and help people, wanting to serve humanity, wanting to do what necessary to bring everybody onto the path and not just follow it alone. And these two have been a conflict with me for many years. I remember the first 7 years of lecturing, I used to feel that it was a waste of everybody's time. What was I saying that was worth listening to, that they couldn't get in books and get it better? And it took me a long time, 7 years, in fact, before I began to discover that, in fact, it really was doing good, that there were people who hadn't had faith and suddenly did, people who had been thinking of suicide and now suddenly they wanted to live. And I was touching people's hearts, or God was, through me, and thus I realized that, well, this is a part of my attunement with Him. But again, when I had to build Ananda as another example, the thought of having to go out and earn money when I wanted to meditate, the thought of having to pay off huge bills with people threatening to foreclose and all sorts of crises, and I kept thinking, Divine Mother, why have you given me this? I don't want to be a materialist. I've never been interested in money, and here I've got to think about all this, and I'd much rather meditate. And yet, I had to do it, because if I hadn't, everything would have crashed. And so, again, this conflict. But there, as in the first case, came a very interesting lesson. After I had paid off those first very heavy months of debts that we'd incurred, after I'd met the challenge and successfully, thank God, or we wouldn't be here, I suddenly realized that my gain wasn't the challenge overcome, wasn't the money that I'd gained to be able to pay off the retreat and the construction of the first buildings and so on, that in fact it was a spiritual gain, that I felt stronger in myself than I had felt before. And I came slowly to understand that there isn't a division, that we don't need to make this division between higher and lower duty if we do it all for God. Yogananda one time said that when I was lecturing in the early years in America, I began to worry that I was losing touch with God by all the talking that I had to do. And then I realized that in that very fear of losing Him, I was remembering Him. And then I felt reassured. That same idea, that when we live in the right way, it isn't the burden that it seems. It's rather that, and this is what I finally come to grips with, that my joy is doing that which God has given me to do. And then when we do that, then everything flows smoothly. So dharma must be understood at the outset to be not a burden, but an opportunity, a wonderful opportunity to grow. And whatever your dharma is, I used to feel that it was my bad karma that Master put me in charge of the monks and had me out there as a minister while so many others could remain quietly and humbly in the background. I thought, well, they're the lucky ones and I just have bad karma, and that's why I have to be out here in the public. And gradually I understood that there's no question of bad or good karma. This was my karma. That was their karma. There was one disciple there who was always envious of me because I had all these creative ideas, and I was always envious of him because he didn't have them. I used to feel as if I were sitting on a volcano with all these eruptions all the time, and I simply couldn't help it. I thought the best thing is to go along with it. And I used to think how happy he must be that he doesn't have to deal with that. He can just sit there meditating and give lousy lectures, which he did. Just not be bothered by anything except devotion. And yet I came to see that his way was good, my way was good, any way is good that's your way. Whatever is the right way for you, that is your dharma. And it says in the Bhagavad Gita that it's better to fail in your own dharma than to succeed in someone else's. Because what you've got to work out is what you have to do. I remember meeting a very great saint in India. And he had had a few letters from Dayamata. And so he asked me a few questions about what she did, what her work was. And I explained that she was the president of this organization, what it meant to be the president. And I talked about the size of the organization, the centers everywhere and so on. And he said, oh my goodness, what a burden. And I said, well, sir, you surely aren't thinking of it only as a burden, otherwise you would have to mean that it's her bad karma that she was made president. And you might even go so far as to say that the prime requisite for being made the president of a spiritual organization is having bad enough karma. And I followed this line of reasoning a little bit, and he started laughing, and he said, no, of course I didn't mean that. He said, in her position, she is able to work out her karma more quickly, because she's able to do all this at one time instead of dragging it out over many lives. But he said, don't imagine that therefore it would be anybody else's good karma to be president. It happens to be her karma, not good karma, but karma. This is what she has to work out. And for another person to be in that position would be a misfortune, because it wouldn't help them to overcome anything that they had to overcome. It would merely be adding to what they have things that are extraneous to their own spiritual development. So it's very important to understand that your dharma is your own unique dharma, your own, the things that you need to do. There's a general dharma that's true for everybody, that we all need to learn to love, to forgive, to be in joy, to live peacefully. These things are general. But there are specific things that are inwardly right for you because they help you to find God, not because you happen to be a good actor and therefore it's your dharma to be an actor. It may be against your dharma to do that which is what you're good at, because it may feed your ego and get you off the path. Dharma is not what worldly eyes see as your duty. Dharma is that which your soul offers you as your way out of duty back into divine beauty. This is very important to understand, because it follows from this that there are no important or unimportant, more important or less important roles in this life. There isn't anything important except knowing God. And the position that we are placed in is totally extraneous. When a business tycoon gets to heaven, the angels will not gasp that he owns several railroads. It simply won't matter. You will go not with the things that you have done in the world, which will be forgotten. They may put your name on a street, but that's about all it'll amount to. You will be who you came with, that is to say, this naked little body, and the character that you were born with, what plus what you have added or subtracted in the interim. Your character, the attitudes that you have developed, these are what will matter. And all the little unfulfilled engagements and desires and so on, they won't matter at all. In fact, there will come to you at that time this very intense desire to sort of slip away from it all. There will come this wish to just leave it and go into the other. This won't be that real to you anymore. The thing that will tie you above all will be the relationships that you have built on a soul level with other people. But those relationships, it may be your wife in this incarnation and your son in the next. It may be your mother in this incarnation and your brother in the next. There isn't any, the soul doesn't have sex, the soul doesn't have specific roles. And remember, therefore, that your position in this world is a temporary thing, and your dharma is that which takes you out of that into the infinite. Now, the laws of dharma are to be understood as not just black or white. It's a very, very subtle thing that we need to grasp. For example, the Pharisees were perfectly right in their context when they told Jesus that he shouldn't do anything on the Sabbath. But they didn't understand further, and Jesus pointed out to them the more refined understanding when he said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In fact, Jesus came to break a lot of the old rules and the crystallized, ossified understanding of reality to help people to understand that the rules are merely a vehicle for charity, a vehicle for inspiration, a vehicle for one's attunement. And that if in the name of one particular rule of honoring the Sabbath, in this case, you ignore the welfare of a fellow human being, then in fact you're going against the very rule that the scriptures have offered as a rule. Because, as it says in the Indian scriptures, when a lower dharma conflicts with a higher, it ceases to be a dharma. It ceases to be a right action. If you see that in the scale of values, there is a value that is okay in human eyes, but conflicts with your desire to seek God, then it should be left. I know, for example, what a big thing the West has made, to a large extent based on things in the Bible, of divorce. And of course divorce is, on general principle, not the right thing. But supposing you're married to somebody who is really holding you back from your spiritual life, which is higher? Another incarnation blown, or using this incarnation to find God? I remember one time Yogananda he had it in his horoscope to marry three times, being twice a widower. And each time he refused to fall in with it. The last time they put it, they brought it all the way to the point of having the date set, the marriage feast planned, the invitations gone out, and all these things are planned for the children. So Yogananda didn't really know much about this, I presume. Anyway, he refused to fall in with it, and they were all very upset. And he said, "The only reason you're upset is that you won't get a feast. And I'll arrange it for you. I'll find another bridegroom for this girl." And so he asked a cousin of his, Prabhash Ghosh, if he would marry her. And it was a beautiful girl, and so Prabhash was very thrilled and was happy to marry her. Well, Yogananda went back there in 1935, and he saw this poor cousin of his absolutely henpecked. He would just sort of tiptoe around the house like this, afraid of another reprimand. And Yogananda took her aside. He said, "Listen, I have some right to speak to you because you were meant to be my wife." "If you had treated me the way I see you treating him, I would have left you in 1 week and gone to the Himalayas." And his perfect readiness to leave her, if she was going to just keep pulling him down like that, indicates the Indian attitude toward these things, that if it's conflicting with a higher dharma of really offering your life to God, then it isn't right. But on the other hand, leaving a wife or a husband merely because it's inconvenient or because you don't like it, or that's another story altogether. You should certainly do those things, even which are difficult, which you have taken on yourself, as long as they don't conflict with your higher duty to serve. For example, supposing somebody here were married to somebody, and then his wife or her husband, however the case might be, said, "I'm tired of living a spiritual life. I want to go out in the world, and I expect you to come with me because we've pledged eternal union." I would say that the spouse would be perfectly justified in saying, "No, you go. I live for God. Because God is our first union, and our second union is how we live, but always for Him in a worldly context." So there are higher and different, there are different ways of understanding dharma, and it's not easy to understand. You have to understand it from a soul level to understand it perfectly. Otherwise, people can use this very thing that I have just said as an excuse to get out of duty, rather than really to cling to a higher duty. Then in the Bhagavad Gita, we see in the 18th chapter, the last chapter of the Gita, Krishna has been giving rule after rule for living the spiritual life. And at the very end, in the 18th chapter, he says, "But forget all these rules. The highest rule of all is simply to love. And if you can love completely, then don't worry about the rules." There is a lovely story of a woman saint in India. When she was a girl in her teens, she had such love for Krishna, she looked upon Krishna as her bridegroom. And just as Catholic nuns will look upon Christ as their bridegroom. And she, before placing the garland on Krishna's statue, would place it around her own, as if he had garlanded her. And she would look in the mirror and be pleased, and then she would place it on him. Well, to offer something to the deity in India that you've already used yourself is considered an unclean offering. You don't, for example, if you offer a flower to the guru, smell it first yourself. The idea being that it's his. And then if he wants to give it to you, fine. So you offer food to the altar, and after having offered it, then you're allowed to eat it. You don't eat it first and then say, "Bless this food we're about to eat and that which I've already eaten." You offer it completely. So her father saw her doing this one time and became very angry. He was a priest in the temple. And he became very angry and gave her a great scolding. And she felt badly because she knew that her heart was pure, that she'd done it with love. And that evening, that night, her father had a vision in which Krishna said, "No, let her do it because her offering is pleasing to me." When you have purity of intention, when you have a pure heart, when you do it with love, the rules don't matter anymore. The rules are to help you to purify your heart. But there is a highest rule of all, which is love. And when you have that love, you can break every rule, because The rules, as Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for men, not men for the Sabbath. When you understand the flow of divine love, then who cares about the rule book? When you know how to drive, you don't need the manual. And so, when we get into the subject of right dharma, we must understand it on a spiritual level above all, and secondly, we have to understand it on a relative level, that there are different degrees of it. We have to understand it intuitively, seeing that it's a matter of what was the rule really for, and being in tune with the higher purpose. And secondly, or fourthly, whatever it might be, we have to recognize that the highest law of all is love. That when you love God, you can forget the rule book. You just can be completely drunk in Him, and that's the most pleasing thing to Him of all. As Yogananda told the story of Draupadi, Krishna said to her one day, "Why don't you practice yoga? All my disciples practice yoga. It's a great science. Why don't you practice it?" And she looked up at him very humbly, but she said, "Master, I would love to, but I can't take my mind away from you long enough to practice." And he only smiled. Because in fact, if you could just be completely lost in the thought of God, who needs yoga? What's the purpose of yoga? The purpose of it is what the meaning of the word is, which is union. And once you've got union, who needs the path? So remember, dharma is that which leads you toward the divine. We should always be guided by that. And what I find is that in this country, above all, people tend to be guided by their desires. They will say, "It feels this way. I feel this way," as if that was the justification. I've talked about marriage and divorce. One of the greatest mistakes in this country is to think that just because it doesn't feel right anymore, you should get divorced. Just because you no longer get the same kick out of each other's presence, you should get divorced. And I've said one side, but now I'm saying the opposite side. That it should only be for major and not trivial reasons that any people separate, that friendships are severed, I'm very saddened by the divorce rate in this country. I believe that it's a terrible thing. There are times when it's necessary. "Well, I'm tired of it, let me get divorced." "Well, it's no longer convenient, it doesn't feel good, she doesn't make coffee the way I like it." Whatever reason it might be, it should be a serious commitment before God and in God and ultimately for God, and it's only because of that for God that there should be any reason for not continuing. So, well, not only, no, because if you've got somebody who's just making your life miserable, what's the use? But too often what happens is that you're making yourself miserable, and I have seen many times a woman, for example, will divorce some man, and 3 years, 2 years, 1 year later introduce her new husband, and he looks exactly like the first one. Then she divorces him and a third one, and he looks just like the first two. People might as well wake up and realize that their problems really begin with them, not with the world outside. You can't change other people and expect to find things different in yourself. You must be able to pull back from your own likes and dislikes, your desires and attachments, and only then can you hope really to be guided by dharma. You should be guided by what is right, not by what you want. And this country and our culture today says exactly the opposite. What you want is what is right. That's not true. Unless we take it to the highest spiritual level and say what you really want, which is to say God, lasting joy as opposed to temporary joy, lasting love as opposed to ephemeral love, but all of these things come very far out of the category of the way most people think when they say do what you want. A lot of people, even in the new movements which teach people to awaken their higher selves and higher powers and all these things, and one lady went and took a course like this to overcome her obesity and her addiction to smoking. And she came back and somebody said, "Well, did you get thinner?" It was obvious she hadn't. "Have you overcome smoking?" It was equally obvious she hadn't. And she said, "Well, no, but at least I've learned to accept myself." Well, that's not much of a beginning. It may be a start. You can't get much very far if you hate yourself for these things, but simply to accept, and that's what a lot of these schools teach you, accept it, it's good, whatever you want, do it. This is what's right, the existentialist idea that be true to your own desires and that's all that matters. And if you, Jean-Paul Sartre took it to the absurd extreme of saying, therefore, if you feel like murdering, if you feel like stealing, if you feel like outraging all the mores of society, it doesn't matter because you're being true to yourself. In his play Orestes, Orestes kills Clytemnestra, his mother, and then stands before the citizens of Argos and says, you see me, citizens of Argos, at last a free man. Because nothing that society teaches could possibly tell you to kill your own mother. Therefore, this was a deed that he did creatively out of his own inner self, and this was his glory, his crowning act, his triumph. Sartre, by giving such absurd examples, actually completely undermined the whole existentialist you might almost call it plot, because it's a plot against sanity. Obviously, we're living in a world where other people's needs are to be considered, and anybody who doesn't consider them becomes an absolutely hidebound egotist, and you never see a hidebound egotist who is happy. It's a contradiction in terms. The more selfish you are, the more unhappy you are. The more selfless and giving you are, the happier you are. It's a formula that never, never varies. It's always true. And thus they have gone away from the reality, but they've helped to uncover some of the debris that was covering that reality, because it's equally true that a thing isn't right merely because society says it's right. Society has often said absurd things. There are tribes in Africa, for example, that consider it weakness to be kind. There are gypsies in Tuscany, tribes in Tuscany, who believe it's a sign of not being truthful, that you can't lie intelligently. There are many completely mixed up values that society foists upon its members through the ignorance of the majority of people. But you do need to strip away outward influence and get in touch with your soul. You need to be able to withdraw from attachment and desire if you're ever to be guided by the truth within. Otherwise, there will be all sorts of rationalizations to justify what is obviously a wrong act in the first place. We see people, we do it ourselves probably, we have to always watch, and the only way to watch is to be somewhat withdrawn from the scene so that you don't go get all excited just because everybody's excited. You step back and think, well, is it true? Not just automatically it's false, and I'm going to show it's false, but just back off a little bit and see, is it true? What militates against this is the attitude spoken of in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that from identification with things, from gazing at things and observing them with identification comes attachment, desire. From desire and attachment come anger. You see, what happens is that the soul, when it enters the body, the soul, the ego is the soul identified with the body. It's a particularization. The soul is infinite, but it begins to be responsible for one particular little dot in this vast infinity of reality. And this little dot of a body, it enters into more and more and more. The further you enter into that particular, the more you escape forget the greater reality that is what you really are, your true self. And in that particularization, what happens is not merely identification with the body, but particularly because of likes and dislikes, the feelings of the heart. That's why you have to get rid of feeling and be guided by truth, because feeling is such a mishmash. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But true feeling is not that feeling, not the feeling on an emotional level. True feeling is that which is in tune with the intuition of the soul. Now then, from that comes desire and attachment. You begin to think that I need this, I like this, I don't like this, I want this for my happiness. And then, the Bhagavad Gita says, then comes anger. If you don't get what you want, then you become all angry. And then from anger comes hatred, because from that attachment to the desire, then when you find something that is interfering with that desire, preventing you from fulfilling that desire, then you fix on the negative side. It was bad enough when you fixed on the positive side of wanting this, wanting that, and becoming all sucked into a reality that isn't real at all. It's really only a dream. It's real as a dream. But then you shift your attention even from that as the source, and you start concentrating on the things that are preventing you from getting that. Then you start concentrating even more and on hating this and wanting to get rid of it and get it out of your world and so on. And so comes punishment, revenge, murder, all the negative things that happen. Long before this, the mind and the ego are so completely lost in delusion that there's absolutely no way out until they wake up, open their eyes, and begin to understand where it all began. It didn't begin with that person interfering with his desire. It began with the desire. It didn't begin with the desire. It began with the attachment to ego. It began with the attachment to limitation. You can never get out of these things by just always going further and further into them, thinking that if you can finally get rid of all those things that bug you, then at last you'll know peace of mind. Because what made them bug you in the first place? The fact that you had desire, and that they were conflicting with that desire. You must learn to rise above wanting this and letting your impulse to do anything be a desire for this. Be always detached in your own self. Be always removed inwardly. Always mentally, at the end of every day, say that everything that I own, everything that I'm working for, I offer at your feet. If I should die tonight, I will die a free soul, because nothing in this world is something I'm attached to. I don't need anything. I don't really want anything. As long as I'm here, I work enthusiastically, but for you, not for me. When you can learn to have that degree of freedom, then you find, and then only, that the right guidance comes to you. People used to say about Master, oh, he loves mangoes, for instance. He enjoyed mangoes, but he would have been just as happy if he hadn't had mangoes, because what he enjoyed was joy. And he could project that joy onto things, but without attachment, because he could always see that he wasn't that. I remember the last evening before he left his body, and a friend in Florida had sent him some green coconuts. This is something that a Bengali boy growing up in Bengal would love, because it's a wonderful drink there, very cooling in the summertime. And so Master, who in this country never saw green coconuts, was absolutely delighted to get these green coconuts. He said, a last desire is fulfilled. But I looked into his eyes, and it was so interesting, because I could see he wasn't touched at all. He was just playing along with the game. When you are free inside, then you can do anything, because you know it's not you. But until then, try to keep free inside. Don't allow yourself to go pell-mell after everything that presents itself to you. Always tell yourself that, no, I am the soul. I am not these things. And I want to be guided by what is right. I want to be guided by God's will. I have seen, because Ananda is a wonderful laboratory. It's a place where people, because there's so many interacting, but all for a basic understood desire to find God. And sometimes they slip from that desire, sometimes they get upset with somebody, or whatever it might be, but there's always that underlying and ulterior purpose without which people wouldn't remain here. And so you see that it's much more of an interesting laboratory than where people don't even know where they're heading. Here they're all trying to head in the right direction, but sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. And it's much easier to see in this laboratory why it works and why it doesn't work. I have seen over the years that invariably those people who thought first in terms of what they want don't ever get it together. Those people who think in terms of what does God want? What is best for everybody? These people are always happy, and their happiness is always growing. I've seen that this is an infallible law. If people think, first, I've got to get my thing together, and then I can think about other people. Years later, they're still trying to get my thing together. Whereas those people who think, no, I'm here for God, I'm living for Him, He'll take care of me, somehow, if their faith is dynamic, He always does. And this is how this whole community has survived. I remember a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago said that back in 1970, I think, her father came here, and he stayed here for a few days, and he was a very sort of proper professor from a Midwestern college, I believe, or an Eastern college. Anyway, she said to him finally, how do you like it? He said, this is worse than the grapes of wrath. And that's how people looking at our community back 18 years ago, 17 years ago, whatever, must have seen, because in fact that's rather what it was. It wasn't at all that way to us, because we loved it. We were living for God. But because we lived for God, He's given us such a wonderful community and so many wonderful things, and it's just everything. Seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things will be added unto you, as Jesus said, as Yogananda never tired of quoting. And so, on the other hand, those people who decided that they had to shake literally the dust of Ananda off their shoes and leave, I've seen that in most cases they're struggling still. People who thought, well, they'd go off and found another community, not one of them has succeeded. Because when you do a thing not with desire, but to please Him, He takes care of you, and He really does. So be guided not by desire, be guided by dharma. Be guided by God's will in everything that you do, and you will see that His will is your will, that He really wants your happiness, and that you will never be so happy as if you offer your will up to Him. Let's meditate a few moments.